Good to have all of you here today. I appreciate you people who are suckers for self-flagellation coming in here. That's a good thing to do. This is a more difficult lecture because the first two were history. We can look back on, we can say they did this, they could have done this, and we make an amalgam of it and we do an analysis of it. Today, I'm part of it. I go a long ways back. My folks were baptized in 1936, and that made me a member, sort of an associate member at that particular point. Where does he go to church? Well, he's a member down here. Well, how old is he? Well, he's 9, you know, that sort of thing. Well, I've been around and I've heard an awful lot of songs in an awful lot of contexts. So just keep that in mind. I have to be careful what I put down because it may not be correct because I'm reacting to it emotionally or because I grew up in Indiana or because I have a couple of degrees in music. Got to be careful about it. To understand our present-day liturgy and hymnody, we need a quick look at the history of the hymnals used by Churches of Christ. In the last class, we briefly mentioned the hymnals of Alexander Campbell and Barton W. Stone, which were published in 1828 and 1829, respectively. After much argument by these two preachers and others, these two hymnals were combined in 1834. That new publication quickly became the dominant hymnal in the New Unity Movement and would retain its number one spot into the 1850s, another 20 years or so. However, during that time, notes came into almost everybody else's church hymnal. However, we had hymnals printed for our restoration movement for the Stone-Campbell movement, since that movement began going all the way back to Abner Jones, Elias Smith, Rice Haggard, and James O'Kelly, who all had hymnals. Even Joseph Thomas, the white pilgrim, who wore a white robe and rode a mule to his preaching appointments, you may not remember him that well, devised his own hymnal in 1815, which went through two editions. Thomas called his collection the Pilgrim's Hymn Book, with a subtitle stating that the hymnal was offered as a handbook for all Zion travelers. All of these hymnals were, of course, words only and quite small. Campbell's first edition had only 125 hymns, but it also had a poem, a preface on psalmody, and an appendix on prayer, you know, to sort of beef it out a little bit. After these early publications, our movement hit an arid spot in the late 1800s as far as hymnal publishers were concerned. We did have a few other collections of hymns privately published, and of course there were the Fillmore brothers, James and Fred, our brothers, who had their own hymnal publishing house in the last half of the 1800s. But none of these were of any very high quality. Although the Campbell hymnal was a hardback, most of the hymnals we used were cheap paperbacks, which were designed to wear out quickly and be replaced each year. That was a deliberate financial decision by the various hymnal publishers. Then in 1905, a man named William Edward Michael Hackelman, William E.M. Hackelman from Indianapolis, I'll say, one of our brothers from Indiana, published a fine hardbacked hymnal with an excellent selection of hymns. Quite a fine selection, actually. He titled his hymnal Gloria in Excelsis, Glory in the Highest. 6 years later, keeping that Latin style, Hackelman published a second hymnal titled Hymne Ecclesiae, Hymns of the Church. Latin titles for the Churches of Christ. Needless to say, the sales weren't all that strong despite the quality of the collection. I was able to get copies of both of those, one from Amazon and one from eBay for $6 on each one of them. So, and I looked up the listing of them, and they were very fine hymnals, just outstanding hymnals, as a matter of fact. In 1910, Elmer Leon Jorgensen, who was born in 1885, E.L. Jorgensen, moved from Iowa to Louisville, Kentucky to help a congregation with his worship. More specifically, Jorgensen moved to get more training in music and to prepare a hymnal. In 1921, he published Great Songs of the Church, 400 hymns in round notes only, added a 50-hymn supplement the next year, then republished it, the combined work, in 1925 in both shaped and round notes. It should be noted that many of the hymns in Jorgensen's Great Songs came from Hackelman's two hymnals. You would be amazed at this. Something like 240 hymns were common to those two hymnals. From those beginnings in 1906 and 1921, we moved to 1935 when the Gospel Advocate Company, seeing the huge sales records of Great Songs, commissioned L.O. Sanderson,
to prepare a 400-song hymnal to be called Christian Hymns. Although it is almost entirely based on the list of hymns in Jorgensen's hymnal, Great Songs of the Church, Sanderson's hymnal also contained the first publishing of Be With Me, Lord, Bring Christ Your Broken Life, and Buried With Christ, Our Blessed Redeemer. You probably thought those songs were much older, but they are indeed from 1935. To give this some perspective, if you attended ACC before 1966, Be With Me, Lord was less than 30 years old at that time. As the Deer is right now 32 years old. And Blue Skies and Rainbows is 45 years old. And this old guy over here and I were back there when we first put it out. I didn't write it. Gary Mabry wrote the thing, but he was in the choir, so we did it. Older members considered these our new hymns. New hymns that are 35 years old. Even established hymns, which were not in our hymnals back in the 1930s or when we were children, are often considered new because we didn't grow up with them. Praise to the Lord the Almighty wasn't in any of our hymnals until ACU published a 70-hymn supplement to Great Songs back in 1975. A nice lady thanked me for publishing that new hymn. I didn't want to tell her it came out in the 1600s. I was but a child at the time. That 1935 publication of Christian Hymns ate into the sales of Great Songs, so Jorgensen did what any good entrepreneur would do. He re-edited his hymnals, expanded it to 600 hymns or hymn-like music. Did you ever go back in the back at Radio Hymns and some other stuff like that, Radio Zone? There are songs that are absolutely secular songs. They're just songs, plain old sing songs. And they had instrumental accompaniment, and then we had that trumpet trio that is an entrance to God of Our Fathers, you know. How did we do that? Well, we just sort of didn't look at that particular one. Those two hymnals, the publication of Christian Hymns ate into that, into the sales, so they re-edited, called it Old Blue because of the old, almost indestructible blue pebble binding. Uh-huh. Lasted forever. The only one that's lasted for even longer than that is our current one, which is not in current right now, Great Songs Revised. We made the ghastly mistake of binding it in leather. We still use it at our place 26 years later. They won't wear out. You know, they won't dry. Everything's there. It just stays there. Although those two hymnals, but most particularly Great Songs, provided the basic hymnody for Churches of Christ throughout the United States. Although there were other hymnals, the New Ideal Hymn Book, the Majestic Hymnal, the Complete Christian Hymnal, and a few others, none had the widespread acceptation of Jorgensen's and Sanderson's hymnal. To be honest about it, every hymnal after about 1925 was merely a reordering of the basic list of hymns from Great Songs. Curiously enough, most sales of Sanderson's Christian Hymns were to churches east of the Mississippi, and most of Jorgensen's sales of Great Songs came from west of the Mississippi. Part of that was a problem with Jorgensen being too well known as a premillennialist, thinking this Christ is going to come back for 1,000 years. And hymns such as All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name were anathema to mainline non-millennialist churches. One song, hymnal goes out. Although Christian Hymns went through 3 editions, none of them ever included All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name. Of course, we had some problems with a few picky and noisy scholars who kept wondering just what the differences were between a psalm, a hymn, and particularly a spiritual song. The last name posed the most serious problem because it had that pesky little word, spirit, in it. We solved those problems by simply ignoring all 3 items. It takes some time to edit and publish a hymnal. That usually means someone older with money. And it was the editor's money. Then the editor chose all of the songs. The music in these single editor books were the hymns or gospel songs remembered by that older editor. The hymns coming from well before World War I. Many of the songs were completely out of date, often using a quasi King James language in hymns such as 'Tis the Blessed Hour of Prayer, 'Neath the Shadow of the Almighty, How Dreary 'Twould Be Without Jesus, or Hark, 'Tis the Shepherd's Voice I Hear. All of that material, we sing it because we grew up with it too. We don't even see it anymore. Those are the invisible words that are just there. For the older Christians, this artificial Shakespearean verbiage brought back images of a childhood listening to popular songs such as Adieu, Tis Love's Last Greeting, and Wilt Thou Think of Me. These were secular songs, which were sung to them by their parents or grandparents. That's how you know a writer of the hymn knows little or nothing about hymnody, when you see those Shakespearean or King James phrases in hymns theoretically written for the 21st century. If you see a word you don't commonly use, think about maybe dropping that hymn or modifying it in some way. We did a little bit of that in Great Songs Revised, not enough. Our Church of Christ hymnody remained with this closed listing for 3 decades. No new hymns were added to our worship other than the occasional specially printed hymn, which would be pasted in the front or back of a local hymnal. By the mid-1940s, the hymnody of the Churches of Christ had essentially frozen. We sang an aging list of hymns. We were not unique. Many other groups sang the same aging songs. I mentioned last class the Broadman Hymnal, a Baptist publication from 1940 with a list of hymns not far from our own, Songs of Faith and Praise and some Praise for the Lord, and very close to the old Songs of the Church that came out in 63 or 4. Meaning both were filled with sentimental favorites from the years between the Civil War and World War I, the great sentimental age of American music, hymnody, literature of all kinds. However, unbeknownst to virtually all members of the Churches of Christ, some new winds were beginning to blow through the hymnody featured in the various Christian denominations in America. And here's where this class actually begins. About 1950, the Pentecostal church began looking around and they discovered that they were not attracting enough younger members to their churches, so the Pentecostal leaders began deliberately developing a new style of hymnody based more on popular music, modern popular music, which at that time meant music for the 1930s and 40s, well before the rock and folk music revolutions of the 1950s and 60s. From the standpoint of musical style, we can now see that it was dated, but it was way more up-to-date than Hark, Tis a Shepherd's Voice I Hear. The Pentecostal church and others had always used instruments for their crowd-pleasing qualities, but now, instead of an organ or a piano, they added drums, guitars, and other instruments to parallel the small instrumental ensembles used in popular music, and they wrote music to match the popular sounds of the time, 1952, meaning music a lot like Benny Goodman and Harry James. This was the popular music of that time. It was left over from the 1930s and early 40s. The Pentecostal churches began to attract members, lots of them, many of them young. In 1960, they latched onto the new hymn, There's a Sweet, Sweet Spirit in This Place. And by the way, the Spirit means Spirit, the Holy Spirit, not a nice spirit within you. Which became, as a friend of mine described it, the Pentecostal national anthem because, probably, the jazz-influenced line in the chorus, without a doubt, we'll know that we have been baptized. Revived. The Holy Spirit and its work came out front and center and infused both the Pentecostal message and its hymnody. In the 1960s, other religious groups, not Churches of Christ, were beginning to notice a membership explosion of the Pentecostal churches. The National Organization of the Baptist Church began publishing and distributing to their members new choral pieces which utilized the same exciting, pops-based sounds begun by the Pentecostal Church. No longer would one more choral arrangement of Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee, accompanied by a Hammond organ and a solo trumpet, be enough for the congregation or the choir. In 1967, Broadman Press, the Baptist publishing house in Nashville, published a full-bore musical play titled Good News. It placed younger people, particularly high school and college-age students, up in front holding mics and urging the audience to clap along. Thousands of productions of Good News brought this new sound to the Baptist churches. No costumes, minimal staging, high school and college kids singing. What's not to like? The same decade of the 60s featured a large traveling group of young musicians performing the variety show Up With People. It was created so, quote, the young people can have their own music,
Pops music. And it was exciting music. It eventually had four touring companies, one of them in Europe. By the 1970s and 80s, other groups, Methodists, Presbyterians, whatever, began looking around for something to brighten up what had become a predictable worship service. The music was what got brightened. A few new hymns came out of this era, notably Jesus is Lord, Something Beautiful, and Without Him I would be nothing. Even the churches of Christ, always 10 to 20 years behind, we've always been that way. We have to be, 20 years is a generation. You have to go to the new generation before you get any kind of a change occurring on a permanent basis. Even the churches of Christ, always 10 to 20 years behind, had a brief burst of creativity in the early 1970s with the so-called Jesus songs. But very few of those songs made it into our worship services. Mostly they were reserved for Bible camps and youth devos. But in the sanctuary, the auditorium, no way was that going to happen. We still have blue skies and rainbows, and occasionally we hear, "Thank you, Lord. But how long has it been since you heard, I've got my head in heaven and my feet on the earth. I'm giving the man da da da." Nice rhythm, nice finger snapper. And then the one, "Give me oil for my lamp, keep me burning." You remember that one? Which very quickly mutated in, "Give me wax for my board, keep me surfing." Yeah, you remember that one quite well. Yeah, you were admitted at the wrong time. The movement to include new hymns in Churches of Christ worship service staggered and died right there until in the mid-1990s we suddenly, if anything after four decades of lethargy can be called suddenly, we suddenly discovered this new kind of popular religious song which our high schools and college kids were listening to on their Walkman and singing in their devotionals. Then they began asking why we weren't singing those same songs we heard on the radio in church. We began using a few of those new hymns, often with projected words and sometimes with a praise team of 4 or 8 or 12 singers. But we began running into problems, the main one being that the worship leaders were almost all young and untrained in congregational needs. Notice the term. It's a need. It's not a want. It's a need because your emotion is there and you want. There are things that you're going to have there. Any direction or suggestions usually came from others of their own social level and age group. They chose the songs they liked. The congregation was almost never consulted. The leadership of the congregations, all ill at ease in an area that emphasized their own lack of training, seldom put limits on how many and what kind of songs could be sung. We turned the worship over to the people who liked the new songs, and in many congregations, only new songs were sung. In some congregations, traditional hymnody virtually died out. The inmates were running the asylum. Our son and our family and his family lived in Nashville, so in the spring of 2000, I quit here and taught a semester at Lipscomb University. While there, Joanne and I attended a well-known Church of Christ congregation. On the first Sunday, we sang 8 songs, with only the hymn, "O Sacred Head," coming from traditional sources and only a single stanza of that hymn. The next week they sang 11 songs, 9 of them new. I had actually heard 4 of them. Except that the songs were not new. They were just new to us. Most of the songs we commonly use now are from the 1970s and 80s. Yeah. "I Am a Sheep" was written in 1988. "As the Deer" and "Come Share the Lord," you know the song, was written in 1984, and "For We Are a Chosen Generation" was written in 1977, and which is now 38 years old. These established older praise songs form the main body of works for many of our current praise services and praise teams. However, when truly new hymns are sung, they are often sung only once or twice and then put aside for the next new song being featured on the local radio, religious radio program. Radio programs must change their literature that they use. They cannot keep doing the same old thing all of the time. They have to have new material or the people will stop listening to them. These new hymns have trouble becoming part of our established repertoire because most of them are here and then they are gone. More about that right near the end of the lesson. How much time we got? Okay, we're going. But back to our timeline. By the year 2000, we in Churches of Christ were safely strapped onto the congregational praise song bandwagon with handheld mics and projected hymns, words only, and TV monitors for the praise team to read from. And we got on this bandwagon, wait for it, just as other religious groups began jumping off. Many denominations are now pulling back from the use of praise bands and the introduction of new pops-oriented song in their worship, except as specials where the group is featured and the congregation is merely a silent audience. Tom Fetke, a fine religious musician and a friend of mine from Nashville, edited the Celebration Hymnal, a phenomenally successful ecumenical hymnal with sales of almost 2 million copies. When he was preparing this hymnal, I asked Tom how many of the new praise-type songs he was including. He said, very few. When I asked him why, he said, because the pendulum has already swung back. Keep that pendulum image in mind. And that was 16 years ago in Baptists and Methodists and large Bible churches or community churches. Why would denominations do that? Because their younger members, meaning those in their 20s and 30s, were asking for a more traditional, liturgy-oriented worship. They were asking for history. They were asking for tradition. They were asking for predictability. I heard a couple of them say that they were tired of constant change. And so are many of our congregations as well. How many Churches of Christ in Abilene use praise teams? Not all that many. You go around and the further north you go, the fewer you find there. The smaller the congregation, the fewer that you're going to find. It's hard to get the people that have the qualifications and the time to do it. Let me describe our Church of Christ hymnody and worship. Despite what we think we remember, we have not been a religious group that trained our congregations to sing. Back in the day, in college, one of the ways I got through there was by leading singing schools, 1 week, a couple of them for 2 weeks, or a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday thing. And there were a little bit of that, but not a lot. A week-long or weekend-long singing school every 5 years was not training our congregations. Every congregation had a few strong singers who learned to sing in high school or college choruses, and we had a much smaller number of members who attended singing schools, but a brotherhood-wide or even congregation-wide emphasis on learning to sing was unknown. That's not our memory, but that's a fact. We think of ourselves as having trained our people. Didn't do it. For sure, a few isolated congregations did and do some training, but it has not been a brotherhood-wide movement. This kind of laissez-faire attitude toward our congregational music in the 1980s and 90s demanded a simplistic music, a folk music, if you will. Folk music is music that can be sung by the folks, meaning those members with little formal training. It demands that the music be easily sung and the words very personal. We've already seen how our Church of Christ hymn of the late 19th century and early 20th century was influenced by popular styles. But remember, at that time, popular meant singable. Mm-hmm. If you didn't write a tune that could be sung by amateurs at home, that tune would not be published and thus not purchased, and no money would change hands. In the 1990s, the simplified folk-like music in our churches often featured simple-minded texts. Repetition of simple phrases such as, I just love the Lord, was often repeated like a mantra. That's one of the problems I have with Taizé services. Been in some, participated in some. Speaking of which, have you heard of a Taizé service recently? On a regular basis? No. They'll throw them in because, hey, I think we've got a good idea here. Let's try it. Okay, try it. But it's not an influence. That music will not stand up. There's almost nothing out of Taizé that is used commonly in our Churches of Christ today. It's way too simplistic. Unfortunately for us, many, even most of the new so-called praise songs are not designed to be sung by groups of amateurs. Remember this, virtually all of the newer praise songs have been written specifically to be performed by professional soloists, mm-hmm. not choirs.
You don't hear recordings of them sung by congregations or even choirs. Virtually all of them are sung by soloists with several instruments and a backup trio. And they're delightful to listen to. They're great to listen to. But when you put them in a worship service, you're going to be listening to them, unfortunately. They are not written with a congregation in mind, particularly not an a cappella congregation. Southern gospel singers often working out of Nashville, Stephen Curtis Chapman, Twyla Paris, Amy Grant, 100 others, these wannabes, these performers drive this hymnody, and when they perform the songs, which they often write, they must give a personal stamp to the melody. Must be, the fans demand it. Otherwise, it would be just a bland melody that anybody could sing. They don't want a song that anybody can sing. They want a song that is instantly identifiable with them. This means syncopated and ornamented melodies, often unusual chord progressions, and a key that favors their voices, which is usually too low for group singing, but when it comes out, there it is, too low for group singing. And you'll have that in the in some of the hymnals that are around. They're just badly written material and badly arranged, and you can tell. I'm gonna throw in a parenthesis here about songs. There are three kinds of songs. There are singer songs, piano songs, and guitar songs. Singer songs, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, can be sung. Maybe a little bit problem occasionally, but they can be sung. They're grateful to the voice. They're fun to go through. Piano songs have a melody that are recognizable and are really nice. Bass line, which follows the thumped bass down at the bottom, and then the alto and tenor just filling it in. Does it make sense? Not necessarily. Maybe too high, maybe too low. It just doesn't work. That's a piano song. Guitar songs are the most egregious. Those are the ones where somebody came up with a really cool set of chords, you know, going through it. And then, after you get the chords going, then you go, I just really love the Lord. I want to love the Lord. The Lord knows I love Him. And so you get these ghastly songs that have about three notes in them, and that's all they're there. And you know instantly, this dude had a guitar, and he wrote the guitar part first, and then he added a tune on top of that, which he thought was phenomenal, and will sound good if you have another guitar, I mean, if you have a lead guitar and a rhythm guitar and a bass guitar and drummers and maybe a saxophone and three backup singers. You can get through with that because you can manipulate it with your board there that you're working off of. Southern gospel singers. This means syncopated and ornamented melodies. Further, there is a financial reason for changing the words and ornamenting the melody. Royalty on recorded songs and hymns are about 9 cents per song, a little more now. This is usually split equally between the writer of the words and the composer of the music. However, if you, the singer, change something, anything, then you can claim artistic involvement, and the royalty is split three ways instead of two ways. And the going phrase is, change a word, get a third. That's enough. It's that's not me. Maybe that's Nashville. That's an important reason the singers change things, and that's the reason many of the songs are impossible for congregations to sing. Congregations have trouble with ornaments. Our younger singers in church, which usually include our praise team leaders and a few older members, they want these received versions they hear on radio or CD or MP3 downloads to be transferred over to be sung in church. But often the songs can't be sung by groups of people. Now, we will mumble through them, but we can't, and you've got a praise team doing the work, but they can do it. They are designed for soloists. The very thing that makes them attractive to listeners of CDs or downloads is what makes them extraordinarily difficult and occasionally impossible for singing by an a cappella congregation. But then the kids turn up angry if you try it because the a cappella congregation version doesn't sound like the songs that they download. Well, no, they don't have it. They asked me about that when we were doing one of the songs over to our congregation. I said, well, our drummer was gone today. He just wasn't sure. He actually was out there. He's my son-in-law. He's a 6'7" guy that teaches drum here at Abilene Christian Percussion. But that's not what the problem was. There's no way you can make it sound like an MP3 version when you don't have the drum and the saxophone. Mm-hmm. It just can't be done. Of course, the praise teams can sing them, but they meet to practice and they have microphones to help when the pitch is too low. And there is a performance dimension to a visible praise team that detracts us from the congregation's poor contribution. Let me make one thing crystal clear. There is nothing immoral or unchristian about using a praise team. It's a group of your members singing. That's all. If you want it and need it, then use it. If your singing needs the undergirding of an amplified group of your singers, then use a few of your singers amplified. Parentheses, we were out in Ruidoso, we had a place out there, and we went to church out there. It's a really neat little congregation, 150, 175 members. And my wife turned to me and said, what do you think of the praise team? I said, they haven't got one. They got one guy's up leading singing. She said, no. And we knew one of the sopranos. She said, the soprano's right over there with a mic, and the alto's down here. And I think that's the tenor back there. They had a quartet. They had a mic. They had voices that blended. And what they did was to fill out the harmony. I didn't even know they were there. My kind of praise team. Remember this another thing here, the thing that I won't get too probably around here, and that is, if as a song leader, if they know you're there, you're doing something wrong. If they know that you're there, why do they notice that you're there? Back off and don't do that. Don't wave your arms so much. I've gotten down now to I give it the first measure and the last measure to tell what's coming next, and that's all. I just stand back and let them go. Sometimes I stop singing, and they just keep on. They get better when I stop singing. They think I'm losing my voice or my mind, one of those two. We use stained glass to amplify the religiosity of our buildings. We have beautiful carved pews and communion tables to give an image that says, this is a church. If a praise team can help with the worship, then if you wish, use a praise team. But if you're using a praise team because you believe it will bring in more young couples and will keep our high school kids pure, you're in for a troubled awakening. Even worse, if you want a praise team because the church down the street is using a praise team, you might want to rethink that decision. You will recall that the Israelites asked for a king because everybody else had a king, and that worked out so well. Remember this, a praise team is simply a substitute for an organ, piano, or praise band. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever told you that before, did they? Think about it. What's the difference? It leads you in the service? Yeah. Does it get in the way? Well, it depends on the congregation and whoever's doing the leading. Remember this, praise team is simply a substitute for an organ, piano, or praise band. Historically, instruments were introduced when the congregation couldn't sound good alone. The instruments covered up this fact. A praise team does the exact same thing. It gives the impression that a congregation is singing loudly in four-part harmony when often it is not singing at all. The sound is there, but the congregation isn't making it. A few years ago, I attended a church music symposium at Baylor University in Waco. It's a Baptist university, most of you know. Among other speeches was one by a popular singer who goes by the tacky professional name of Johnny Peacock. To my great surprise, his lecture was remarkably insightful, very fine. He made an extraordinary and correct statement. He said, "The music industry is not a comprehensive caretaker of Christian music. The music firms and agents of performers are often managed by Christians, but they are managed for large international corporations, and the design is to make money. Congregational singing is never considered because it will make them almost no money at all. Taking in $100 when a song is included in a hymnal is chump change for these guys with their private jets. Also, it's important that we understand that the praise team and praise song movement is almost exclusively an American phenomenon. It is not worldwide. It is supported almost entirely by American Baptists, Charismatics, and Evangelicals, and the music is primarily for white American Protestants. Some white American Protestants. The further up the food chain you go, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopal, when such songs are used, they are commonly presented as specials, meaning by soloists or the choir. This is not an important part of the congregation's participation. And this praise music is virtually unknown in black churches and Hispanic churches and Oriental churches. There was a book, a hymnal came out, African American
praise hymnal or something. No, that wasn't it. There's something else in the third word there. And I got a copy of it and went through it, and I thought, this is, you know, this is us. We know all these songs now. We've been singing them. They were traditional high church songs, many of them that were in there. Then I turned off to the front to see who the publisher was, and a GIA, the Gregorian Institute of America, Catholic organization. They were printing it for Catholic black churches, and that's what their background was. So what do? First, we have to realize that we have a problem. Several years ago, I was giving this series of lessons in Cisco, Texas, a small town about 40 miles east of here. Most of you know that. And the preacher from there is here today, so I have to be careful. As I was traveling to Cisco on I-20, I noticed a sign advertising a locally owned motel. The sign said, "Good food, clean rooms." This on an obviously homemade and hand-lettered black-on-white sign. I'm assuming here, but I believe that both national and state laws demand that clean rooms be everywhere, for every motel. It's like stating that your motel features air conditioning and free TV. The owners of that motel were out of touch with the needs of modern advertising. It dated them, probably lost them some sales, and certainly cost them very little money. On a succeeding trip to Cisco, I was a bit early, so Joanne and I drove around the town a bit. On another seldom traveled road leading into Cisco, we spied a huge, elaborate, well-designed sign listing in full color the attributes and attractions of Cisco on a road seen by no one. Nobody goes on that old 80 between Cisco and Eastland. It's a wonderful road. It's the only four-lane highway we had back when I was here as a student. And nobody's going to be on that road. That's kind of where we are right now in the churches of Christ. We like to think that just speaking our message in the manner we have spoken for 50 or 100 years will be enough to convert non-believers who have been brought into our service by our praise teams. But a praise team won't bring in anybody to the service, nor will it keep our high school kids from straying. Too often our worship service tell visitors that we're behind the curve. If we do anything in our worship that says we don't really know where we are and we're really old, this may be because our leaders are clueless and searching for a solution, and they are often afraid to make a decision against the wishes of our young people or a few of our noisy older people. What can we do? In any congregation, if we wish to improve the song selection, the first thing we should do is read the texts of any new songs. Read them aloud to whoever asks for them. Whoever asks for them, have them read it aloud. Whichever texts don't make sense as literature, then those hymns should be automatically eliminated. Using them in the congregational worship is not even up for discussion. Remember, putting lip gloss on a pig won't make it beautiful, and adding music to an insipid text will not sanctify that text. Right. I was working on my doctorate up at Iowa City, and the congregation, there's a nice little congregation, probably 150 people, and they always had a scattering of CFC types that were there working generally on graduate degrees, but this one girl was in there, and she wanted to change things, so we had I was a great deal younger then, and so I went out to a devotional that they had put on there, and this girl was there with her guitar, and so she said, "I'd like to sing my song," and I just said, "Well, okay, sing us a song, not the guitar." "No, I have to have the guitar." "Why do you have to have the guitar?" "Well, it doesn't sound right without the guitar." "Well, then it's not a song, it's a guitar piece. That when you have to have it, something that's that important." She was pretty angry at that particular point. Then she started to give me the words, and oh my word, they were so bad. There's a popular praise song with the following words: "Lord, I'm gonna love you, love you. Lord, I'm gonna love you, love you. Lord, I'm gonna love you with all that's in my heart." Stanza two. "Lord, I'm going to follow, follow. Lord, I'm going to follow, follow. Lord, I'm going to follow, follow you with all that's in my heart." Three. "Lord, I'm going to worship, worship. Lord, I'm going to worship, worship." That was not well thought out. Nobody ever sat there and read those words. They had a guitar, and the way they went on that. These words are fine if you are in the second grade. If you progressed as far as middle school, then you really need meat and not jello for your diet. Of course, we have to be gentle when we talk to our members about such insipid hymns, because we have our own old hymn that I call I Have a Savior, the chorus of which states, "For you I am praying, for you I am praying, for you I am praying." And what's the next line?
I'm praying for you.
Oh, that's a marvelous commentary on the first three lines, isn't it? It's a piece of garbage. But we sang it back in those days. Why? Well, because we could. We could sing that. We just had a real simple chord structure, the old three-chord gospel song. Did you ever stop to think how infantile that hymn is? Opening verse, okay, not great, merely okay, but the refrain destroys it. Every congregation needs to establish a worship committee with from 5 to 8 members, and if you don't have a worship committee, you're hurting, because you're not doing what you can do to improve the worship. 5 to 8 members, old and young, men and women, and don't include the preacher. Don't put the preacher in it. And if you can get rid of the song leader, that's not bad either. This committee should not be led by the song leader. The song leader is only a member and does not have veto power over hymn choice. In my experience, what has always happened when a worship committee is established is that the worship service goes high church immediately, because every item, Bible reading, song choice, projection, choice of participants, whatever, has to be defended. When they put it in, they have to say why they want it there. And you've got a whole bunch of people over here doing that, not a song leader picking it out because it's his favorite song. But I love that hymn. It's not a reason to use it. My mama sang that hymn when I was in kindergarten. It's not a reason. This song is really big on the radio right now. Also gets the hymn dropped if it doesn't fit your needs or if it can't be sung. If it's a proper hymn, but the song leader says he doesn't know that hymn, tell him he has a week to learn it. If he can't learn a new hymn well enough so that he can lead it in a week, what's he doing up there? Why is he there? Go get somebody else. Hire somebody. Send him to school. And, you know, if they say, well, what am I going to do? Take a year of piano, first. Take a year of voice training, second. Then you're going to be way better off as a song leader, because you're able to do something. Learn the songs. Be able to sight read them. Remember, the worship service is for the congregation, not for a few individuals, and most assuredly not for the worship leader. And while we're on this worship committee thing, it's imperative that you keep records of the hymns you sing. Make a list of all of the hymns your congregations know and type them into a database. This one is from Excel, and I've had this one in from an early version, about 20 years old, and I just modify it and keep it up to date. And I take care of every song when we sing it. We begin on the first Sunday in September, and then we keep it going till the last Sunday in August. Then I take this out, and I send it off to the people that are Middle-aged, maybe I said it, I don't know. We have 4 worship groups. Each one has a song leader, and we take it Sunday, first Sunday, second Sunday, third Sunday, fourth Sunday, fifth Sunday. Either the high school kids or the college students do it, and they pick up a song leader. Then they each have a worship committee to do that. And they use this to say, well, we've used that twice in the last 3 months. Let's not use that particular song. We've got a whole bunch of songs in here that we can use for our projections. I make the projections. We've got 560 songs, I think it is, all told, counting our Mitter Lane hymnal over there. What happens is you have to get these songs, and they have to know what you have, what can you sing, and what have you done too much. Make a list of all the hymns your congregation knows, all of them, type the list into a database on your computer, then print it out. When you start notating in your list every hymn which is sung in your worship services, you will probably notice that you have a group of about 50 hymns that get the bulk of the inclusions. I've kept record in my congregation for over 30 years. I've still got them all filed away back there. And there's a copy in this black notebook up here for you to take a look at. Because we operate on the school year, I give them to all of our praise teams. At that time, I just put them on and get them on a PDF file, and I send it off to them. When I show them that hymns as fine as Son of My Soul or Savior Grant Me Rest in Peace hasn't been used in 5 years, it gets their attention. When they see that a song that's marginal has been used 6 times in a year, It gets their attention. They're intelligent people. Here's another solution. Have the leader of the congregation, leaders of the congregation, dictate a rule. I call it the rule of 50. 50% old hymns, 50% new hymns. That makes for a good mix because everybody gets something every time you meet to worship. We do that automatically at our congregation, but in other places, the leadership will have to police it. Some services, particularly if you've got one guy running the thing, some services will be 60-40% going either way, but your record keeping will show you when too many of one or the other style has been used. Our congregations need new hymns, but we also need old hymns. Our young people need to know our history, warts and all, and to understand us, they need to know our hymns. And that means some pretty sorry gospel hymns every once in a while to say, this is what we came out of, this is what we're using today. Finally, quit worrying. You need to understand that in the area of popular songs, 99% of all popular songs die within 3 months of their being published or performed. Doesn't that make you feel good? Cole Porter wrote some of the finest popular song, Indiana Boy, America's ever heard. Hundreds of them. How many of them do you hear today? None, unless you're playing them. The Beatles recorded over 230 original songs. Another 70 were covers, but they did 230 original songs, a tiny handful of which have become standards. But how many of those standards are actually played on the radio or are given covers by the bands of today? Can you say, Chickory Chick, Chala Chala, Chekalaroma? Yeah, you're starting to sing along on that. That's from 1945. How about There Was a Boy, a Very Strange Enchanted Boy, Nature Boy. Who sang that? Nat King Cole. Oh, come on, you're not that old. I'm not that much older than you all. That was from 1948, and then Bronze Ballerina Dance, that was by Vaughn Monroe, and then I have get this one kid said, who's Vaughn Monroe? Oh, man, that hurt. That was from 1949, and then even Achy Breaky Heart from 1992. Okay, we know all of these songs. Have you heard any of those on a regular basis? No. That's odd because each one of those four songs was number one on the hit parade for several weeks. Here's a prediction. In the future, the only place you'll hear those four songs will be over the very loud loudspeakers in the dining room of the rest home where you will be living. For our young people, that's not a nice place to be, I'll just tell you that. The same 99% death rate for secular songs applies to religious songs. It may calm you to understand that in the future you will hear very, very few of the new hymns. Some, very few. And religious songs we discussed this morning, remember, the pendulum keeps swinging, so relax. Something worse may be coming down. may be coming down the pike. That's a scary thing. And I'm going to give you one question, and then after that, come up and talk to me up here. Anybody got a fast question here? Oh, you're wonderful people. You're also mutes. That's nice to know. If you want to see the Mitterlane hymnal, I got the volume 5 and volume 6, the red one up here. I'll have this up there. And I've got the front page off of one of our bulletins to show you how we organize our worship service into four groups. We've done this for 10 years, and it's essentially, you bring them in, you talk to them, you feed them, you send them out. That's what it is. And so you bring them, you have the call to worship, then you have the sermon, and then you have the communion, and then you send them out into the world to do what they're supposed to do. Thank you for listening. You did a good job. Well, there's one question. I'm sorry. Go. You got time. We'll make time.
This in some form or fashion, but I didn't catch it. Where we used to worship like 15 years ago, our minister had a fit because the songbook used round notes. Yeah. He said that was not, he basically felt like
that
I was.
You can't sing it if it doesn't have shape notes.
Notes
are late in well, actually, a version of them came up in about the 12th century, but they died out.
Did I miss something, or was that?
No, it doesn't mean anything. There's another version of it. I'll tell you how you ask them about that. Somebody says, we need to do shape notes, what? And this happened in my congregation. One of my elders said this. And I said, no, we're not going to have shape notes. And well, everybody in our congregation uses shape notes. And so I got up on a Wednesday night, I guess it was, when there were quite a number of people there, and I said, how many of you read shape notes? A whole bunch of hands went up. And I said, how many of you know the shape of fog? Two hands. If you don't know the shape of fog, if you don't know the shape of law, you're not reading shape notes, you're reading round notes with funny shapes. And it doesn't mean a thing in the world. So that, don't hold yourself to a Church of Christ hymnal. Go find the proper hymnal there, and whether it's round notes or whatever it is. Well, everybody else uses round notes. It makes us look a little dated, but that's okay. I've long since figured out you can go to heaven reading the King James Version, and you can go to heaven using shape notes. I'm going to see a whole bunch of really cool people up there. Thank you again.